A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a layered question. He's asking about people who essentially move into hotels, not for a week or a month, but as a lifestyle. What's the maximum you can book? At what point does management start to notice you're not checking out? And then there's the deeper question. Are there cases where people just accept a hotel as their permanent residence without ever signing an indefinite contract? He mentions his own experience as a kid in Ireland when ice collapsed part of his roof and insurance put the family up in a hotel. 2 weeks in, the novelty was gone and it just felt like a cramped apartment. So the real question is, what happens when temporary becomes permanent, and is the system designed to stop that from happening?
The short answer is that the system is very much designed to stop it, but only once you cross a specific legal threshold. And that threshold is almost always 30 days.
The magic number.
It's the line between guest and tenant in virtually every jurisdiction in the United States. Once you've stayed in the same hotel room for 30 consecutive days, you're no longer a transient guest under the law. You're a tenant. And that triggers an entirely different set of legal protections. The hotel can't just kick you out anymore. They'd have to go through formal eviction proceedings, which in some states can take months.
The hotel's incentive is to never let you hit day 30.
And this is why you'll see long-stay guests at places like Residence Inn or Extended Stay America being asked to check out for at least one night before day 30 hits. They literally have to vacate the room, even if they check right back in the next morning. The hotel is resetting the clock.
The hospitality equivalent of tapping the snooze button on tenant law.
That's exactly what it is. And it's not just a quirky policy, it's a legal necessity for them. If they don't do it, the guest can claim tenancy rights, and the hotel suddenly has a resident they can't easily remove. There was a case in California a few years back where a man stayed at a motel in Santa Monica for 31 days straight, and when the motel tried to kick him out, a judge ruled he was a tenant and entitled to all the protections of California's rent control laws. The motel had to go through a full unlawful detainer proceeding.
The hotel business has this built-in ejector seat at day 29, and if they miss it, they've accidentally adopted a tenant.
Like adopting a feral cat.
This applies everywhere?
It varies, but the 30-day principle is surprisingly widespread. In the UK, the Protection from Eviction Act of 1977 draws a similar line. If you have exclusive occupation of a room for a continuous period, you may be considered a tenant rather than a licensee. In Japan, there's a whole category called monthly mansion, rentals that blur the line. They look like hotels, but operate under residential tenancy law. In Singapore, hotels are required to register guests who stay more than 14 days with the authorities under the registration of guest regulations. In parts of Europe, it's more complicated. In Germany, for example, if a hotel guest stays long enough that the room becomes their primary residence, they can register it as their address with the local authorities. Once that happens, the hotel has a de facto tenant regardless of what the booking contract says. The German federal court actually ruled on this in 2014. A man had lived in a Berlin hotel for over a year, registered it as his residence, and the court said the hotel couldn't simply terminate his stay like a normal guest. They had to give him the statutory notice period for residential tenancies.
The guest can effectively force the hotel's hand by just...
And this gets to the core of Daniel's question about whether people just accept a hotel as their residence without ever signing an indefinite contract. The answer is yes, and in some cases, the law effectively creates that contract for them whether the hotel likes it or not.
Let's back up to the people who do this voluntarily. The ultra-wealthy, the ones who aren't trying to exploit a legal loophole, they're just living at the Four Seasons.
This is a well-documented phenomenon. There's a famous case of Coco Chanel, who lived at the Ritz in Paris for 34 years, from 1937 until her death in 1971. She had a suite that she customized extensively. The hotel essentially became her home.
34 years. That's longer than most people stay in houses they own.
She's not alone. Howard Hughes famously lived in hotels for years, the Desert Inn in Las Vegas, the Beverly Hills Hotel. When the Desert Inn tried to evict him in 1966 because he was occupying the entire top floor and they wanted the rooms for high rollers over Christmas, Hughes simply bought the hotel. He purchased the entire property rather than leave.
The ultimate "you can't fire me, I quit" maneuver.
More recently, you've got people like the actor Rip Torn, who lived at the Carlyle Hotel in New York for years. The financier Jeffrey Epstein, before his arrest, essentially lived at his townhouse, but frequently stayed at the Mark Hotel in New York for extended periods. There's a long tradition of wealthy New Yorkers maintaining permanent suites at places like the Plaza, the Pierre, the Waldorf Astoria. The Waldorf had what they called Towers Residences, apartments within the hotel that were sold as condominiums, where you owned the unit but had full access to hotel services.
That's the clean version. The hotel condominium, where the legal framework is designed for permanent residence. But what about the messier cases? The people who aren't buying a condo, who are just extending their stay? Week by week, month by month, what do those people actually say about the experience?
There's a surprisingly rich body of first-person accounts. I found a piece in the New York Times from a few years back. A woman named Dolly Lenz, who was a high-end real estate broker in Manhattan, wrote about spending over a year living in the Saint-Cent Regis with her family while their apartment was being renovated. She described the initial thrill, room service, housekeeping, the concierge handling everything, and then the slow erosion of that thrill. By month three, she said, she started to feel unmoored, no sense of neighborhood, no reason to ever leave the building except that the walls started to feel like they were closing in.
That's the word, isn't it? You're disconnected from the rhythms that make a home feel like a home. No junk drawer. No slightly broken cabinet you keep meaning to fix.
And it connects to something Daniel mentioned about his own experience. 2 weeks in an Irish hotel as a kid, and the novelty just evaporated. He said it felt like a cramped rental apartment. That's the thing about hotels. They're designed for transients. Everything from the lighting to the furniture layout to the absence of personal storage is calibrated for someone who's leaving in a few days. Stay longer, and those design choices start to grate.
The closet has 6 hangers and a luggage rack because you're supposed to be living out of a suitcase. If you're there for 6 months, you're hanging your entire wardrobe on 6 hangers.
This is where the ultra-long-term residents tend to negotiate modifications. The hotels that cater to this, and they do exist, will often allow guests to bring in their own furniture, their own art. Chanel had her own furniture at the Ritz. Some long-stay guests at the Carlyle have been known to ship in their own mattresses.
Wait, they bring their own mattress to a hotel?
When you're paying $40,000 a month for a suite, the hotel is surprisingly accommodating. They'll remove the existing bed and let you install your own.
That's the hospitality equivalent of bringing your own steak to a restaurant and asking the chef to cook it.
The chef will do it if you're paying enough. But here's the thing. Even with those modifications, the people who've done this for extended periods almost universally report a kind of psychological drift. There was a study published in the Journal of Environmental Psychology a few years ago that looked at what they called residential transients, people who live in spaces not designed for permanent habitation, including hotels. The researchers found elevated rates of anxiety and what they described as place attachment deficit. You don't form the same emotional connection to a hotel room that you do to a home, even if you've been there for years.
Place attachment deficit. So you're saying my inability to emotionally bond with the lobby's abstract art is a clinical condition?
I'm saying there's something real happening there. Home is partly about control. Control over your environment, control over who enters, control over how things are arranged. A hotel, by its nature, retains control. Housekeeping enters daily. Maintenance can show up. The front desk holds your keys. You're always, on some level, a guest.
Which brings us back to the legal question. The system is designed to prevent people from accidentally becoming permanent residents, but it's also designed to prevent them from acquiring the rights of permanent residents. The 30-day rule, the forced checkouts, these are all mechanisms to keep the guest a guest.
And it's not just about tenancy law. There are tax implications, too. In most jurisdictions, hotel stays are subject to occupancy taxes. Transient occupancy tax, hotel tax, whatever the local name is, and those taxes are often higher than residential property taxes. If you're living in a hotel for a year, you're paying a significant tax premium compared to renting an apartment.
The government has an incentive to keep you classified as a transient, too.
In New York City, the hotel occupancy tax is 5.875%, plus a flat fee of $2 per room per night. If you're paying $500 a night for a hotel room, that's over $30 a night in occupancy tax alone. Over a year, that's more than $10,000 in taxes that wouldn't apply to a residential lease.
Yet people still do it, so there must be something they're getting that makes it worth the tax penalty, the psychological drift, the six hangers.
For the ultra-wealthy, it's service. It's having a concierge who can get you a table at a booked-out restaurant, housekeeping that makes your bed every morning, room service at 3A, someone to handle every logistical detail of daily life. There's a reason wealthy older people gravitate toward this. It's essentially assisted living without the stigma.
That's a sharp observation. The hotel is stealth-assisted living.
For people who aren't ultra-wealthy but still end up in long-term hotel situations, like Daniel's family after the roof collapse, it's usually an insurance arrangement or a corporate relocation. Those tend to be the Extended Stay America-type properties, which are designed for longer stays. Kitchenettes, more storage, less daily housekeeping.
Even those have limits. I'm guessing Extended Stay America still enforces the 30-day reset?
They do, but they're more flexible about how they handle it. Some properties will let you switch rooms for a night rather than check out entirely. Others will write the reservation as a series of 29-day stays with gaps. The key is that there has to be a genuine interruption in continuous occupancy. That's what the courts look at. If you're just signing a new registration card but never actually vacating the room, a judge might still find that you are a continuous occupant.
The hotel has to make you physically leave. Pack your bags, take your six hangers, and get out for at least one night.
There's case law on this. In a California appellate decision from 2008, the court looked at whether a guest who had checked out and checked back in on the same day had truly interrupted his occupancy. The court said no, he hadn't actually vacated. He had to physically remove himself and his belongings for the break to be meaningful.
Which must be a surreal experience. You've been living in this room for 29 days. It's become your space, however imperfectly. And then the front desk calls and says, "We need you to leave for 24 hours so you don't accidentally acquire legal rights against us."
It's the hospitality industry's version of a prophylactic breakup.
Let's talk about the edge cases, the people who fall through the cracks. Daniel asked whether there are mechanisms in place to prevent weird residence situations, even if people want them. And the answer seems to be, mostly yes, but not entirely.
There are some fascinating gray areas. Extended stay hotels that blur the line with apartment buildings. There's a whole category of properties called apart hotels that operate in this space. They offer hotel-style services, but on residential lease terms. In some cities, they're regulated differently than either hotels or apartments.
Then there are the truly bizarre cases. The famous one, the man who lived in a Tokyo internet cafe for years.
Oh, this is a whole subculture in Japan. They're called net cafe refugees, people who can't afford an apartment but can afford the roughly $15 to $20 a night for a private booth in a 24-hour internet cafe. These booths have a reclining chair, a computer, sometimes a thin mattress. People essentially live in them for months or years. It's not a hotel technically, but it functions as one. You're paying for a small private space on a nightly basis.
In that case, there's no 30-day rule because it's not legally a hotel?
Internet cafes and manga cafes in Japan aren't classified as lodging facilities under the Hotel Business Act. They're classified as entertainment venues, so the tenancy protections don't kick in. You can stay indefinitely, and the owner can kick you out at any time with no legal recourse. It's a loophole that creates a class of permanent transients who have none of the protections of either guests or tenants.
That's bleak. You're neither a guest with consumer protections nor a tenant with housing rights. You're just...
It's not just Japan. In many cities, you'll find people living in storage units, in airport terminals, in 24-hour gyms. The common thread is that they're occupying spaces that aren't legally classified as residences, so residential protections don't apply.
Those are survival situations. What about the voluntary cases? The people who could afford an apartment but choose to live in a hotel indefinitely. Are there famous examples beyond Chanel and Howard Hughes?
The actor Richard Harris lived at the Savoy in London for years. He was once being carried out on a stretcher after a health emergency, and he reportedly called out to the crowd in the lobby, "It was the food." The writer William Faulkner lived at the Algonquin Hotel in New York for extended periods. Elton John has maintained a long-term residence at a hotel in Atlanta. And there's a more modern phenomenon of tech entrepreneurs living in luxury hotels. There was a profile in Bloomberg a few years ago of a startup founder who lived at the Four Seasons in San Francisco for 2 years because he said it was more efficient than maintaining an apartment.
More efficient how? You're paying a nightly rate.
His argument was that when you factor in the cost of a mortgage or rent, plus utilities, plus housekeeping, plus gym membership, plus the time cost of managing all of that, the hotel was actually competitive, and he could move cities on a whim. No lease to break, no furniture to sell.
The nomadic wealthy. They're not tied to a place, so they don't want to be tied to a lease.
This is a growing market. The major hotel chains have noticed. Marriott has a program called Marriott Executive Apartments designed for stays of 30 days or more. Hilton has Homewood Suites and Home2 Suites. Accor has a whole extended stay brand. They're all competing for the long-stay business traveler and the semi-nomadic wealthy.
Those are still designed to feel temporary, right? Even the extended stay brands. They're not trying to be your permanent home.
That's the interesting tension. The hotel industry wants your money for as long as you're willing to pay, but they don't want you to become a legal resident. So they design spaces that are comfortable for a few weeks or months, but subtly resist permanent habitation. The kitchenettes are too small for real cooking. The closets are too small for a real wardrobe. The lighting is hospitality lighting, warm and flattering, but not functional for daily life. Everything signals that you're supposed to leave eventually.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. Comfortable, but not memorable. Designed to be forgotten.
And that's by design. If a hotel room felt too much like a home, guests would start to treat it like one, and that creates legal risk for the hotel.
The entire extended stay hotel segment is an exercise in designing spaces that are comfortable enough to keep you paying, but not comfortable enough to make you stay.
It's hospitality's version of planned obsolescence. The room is designed to wear out its welcome.
Which brings me back to Daniel's core question. Is there a maximum duration? Can you just book a hotel room indefinitely?
Practically speaking, yes, if you have enough money and you're willing to work within the legal framework. The hotel will structure your stay as a series of shorter stays. They'll move you between rooms periodically. They'll have you sign waivers. But if you're paying, they'll figure out a way to keep you.
There's no hard maximum, just a soft one enforced by the hotel's legal department.
The maximum isn't set by law, it's set by the hotel's tolerance for legal complexity. And that tolerance is directly proportional to how much money you're spending.
Which is the answer to most questions about luxury hospitality, honestly.
There's one more dimension worth exploring. Some people end up in long-term hotel situations not by choice, but by circumstance. And those circumstances create their own legal tangles. Think about someone who's displaced by a natural disaster, like Daniel's roof collapse, and placed in a hotel by an insurance company. The insurance company is paying, but the guest is the occupant. Who has the legal relationship with the hotel? And what happens if the insurance runs out before the person has somewhere else to go?
That's a nightmare scenario. The insurance stops paying, the hotel wants you out, and you've been there long enough that you might have tenancy rights. But the hotel argues you were never the paying customer, the insurance company was.
This has actually been litigated. After Hurricane Katrina, FEMA put tens of thousands of people in hotels across the Gulf Coast. Some of them stayed for months. When FEMA announced it was ending the program, a number of those people argued they had become tenants and couldn't be evicted without due process. The courts generally sided with the hotels. The stays were considered emergency shelter, not tenancy, and the guests were there under a government program, not a private rental agreement.
The context of the stay matters. An insurance placement or a government program is different from someone just booking a room on their own credit card.
And this is why hotels have become so careful about the language in their registration agreements. If you read the fine print on a hotel registration card, and I have, because apparently, this is what I do with my time now.
This is who you are as a person.
This is who I am. The registration card almost always includes language specifying that the stay is transient, that no tenancy is created, that the guest acknowledges they are not establishing residence. It's a legal prophylactic designed to head off tenancy claims before they start.
The hotel equivalent of this is not financial advice.
And it works most of the time. Courts give significant weight to what the parties intended at the outset of the arrangement. If you sign something saying you understood this was a transient stay, it's harder to later argue you thought you were a tenant. If the facts on the ground contradict the contract, if you've been there for 6 months, you're receiving mail there, you've registered to vote from that address, you've put down roots, a court might look past the contract language and find a tenancy anyway. The law cares about what actually happened, not just what the paperwork says.
The system has mechanisms to prevent permanent hotel residence, but those mechanisms are permeable. They can be worked around with enough money, or enough legal savvy, or enough desperation.
That's the bottom line. The hotel industry has built an elaborate set of legal and operational guardrails to keep guests transitory. The 30-day rule, the forced checkouts, the contract language, the design of the rooms themselves. It all pushes in the same direction you are passing through. Do not put down roots.
Yet people do. Chanel for 34 years. Howard Hughes buying the hotel rather than leaving. The Net Cafe refugees in Tokyo. The startup founder at the Four Seasons. Humans have this persistent habit of trying to make homes out of temporary spaces, regardless of what the system wants.
It's a fundamental tension. The hospitality industry exists to serve transients, but human beings are territorial creatures. We want to nest. We want to personalize. We want to belong to a place. Put someone in a hotel room for long enough, and they'll start treating it like a home, even if every design cue and legal document is telling them not to.
Which might be the most interesting thing about Daniel's question. He's asking about the mechanics, the maximum booking, the legal limits, the management's attention. But underneath that is a deeper thing. At what point does a space become yours? And can a hotel room ever cross that line?
I think it can, but it requires the hotel to essentially stop treating you like a guest. The Ritz let Chanel customize her suite. The Desert Inn didn't, so Hughes bought the place. The line between guest and resident isn't just about duration, it's about control. Do you control the space, or does the space control you?
For most people in long-term hotel situations, the answer is, the space controls you. You can't paint the walls. You can't change the furniture without permission. You can't even guarantee that housekeeping won't enter while you're in the shower. You're living in someone else's asset, on someone else's terms.
Which is why the people who do this voluntarily tend to either be wealthy enough to negotiate exceptions, or detached enough not to care. The startup founder at the Four Seasons didn't want to paint the walls. He wanted a bed, room service, and a concierge. The room was a service, not a home, and he was fine with that.
The room as service rather than space. That's a distinctly modern way of thinking about where you live.
It connects to larger trends. The rise of co-living spaces, of furnished short-term rentals, of subscription model housing. We're seeing a broader shift away from the idea that everyone needs a permanent, personally owned home. The hotel, as residence, is just the extreme end of that spectrum.
Daniel's question about maximum hotel stays turns out to be a window into something much bigger. The boundary between guest and resident, between service and home, between temporary and permanent. Those boundaries are blurring, and the law is scrambling to keep up.
The hotels themselves are caught in the middle. They want the revenue from long-stay guests, but they don't want the legal exposure. So they've built this elaborate dance. Keep them comfortable, keep them paying, but never let them get too comfortable. Never let them forget they're supposed to leave.
The hospitality industry as a machine for producing mild, persistent discomfort.
I think that's slightly unfair. It's a machine for producing comfort within carefully defined limits. The limits are the point. Without limits, it stops being hospitality and starts being housing.
Which is a different industry with different rules, different margins, different legal frameworks.
When you rent an apartment, you expect to be left alone. When you check into a hotel, you expect to be taken care of. Those are fundamentally different relationships.
What would you tell someone who's considering the long-term hotel life? Someone who's not Chanel rich, but has the means to stay for a few months?
I tell them to read the fine print on the 30-day rule. Understand when the hotel is going to ask you to leave for a night. Negotiate the terms of your stay up front. Can you receive mail? Can you have guests without registering them? Can you refuse housekeeping on certain days? The more you treat the arrangement like a tenancy, the more friction you're going to encounter.
Daniel said the novelty wore off for him in about 2 weeks.
2 weeks seems to be the inflection point for most people. The first week is exciting. Room service, fresh towels, the novelty of hotel life. By week two, you start to notice the things you're missing. A proper kitchen. The ability to leave your stuff out without someone tidying it away. By week three, according to the accounts I've read, most people are ready to go home.
Unless home doesn't exist anymore. Unless the roof has collapsed and the insurance company is still figuring things out.
That's the other side of this. For a lot of people in long-term hotel situations, it's not a choice. It's a displacement. The hotel is a way station, not a destination. And those are the cases where the psychological drift is most acute, because you're not just living in a temporary space, you're living in a temporary life. Everything is on hold.
Limbo with room service.
That's the title of the memoir right there.
To wrap this back to the prompt's specific questions, no hard limit, but the 30-day tenancy threshold means hotels will structure long stays as a series of shorter stays with gaps. They notice almost immediately. Housekeeping is in your room daily, and front desk systems flag extended stays automatically. Universally described as initially thrilling, then psychologically wearing. And the mechanisms to prevent permanent residence? Robust but permeable, legal, operational, and design-level guardrails that push toward transience, but can be worked around.
That's a clean summary. The only thing I'd add is that this is a space where the law is still evolving. As more people live nomadic lifestyles, as remote work makes long-term hotel stays more common, we're going to see more cases testing the boundaries of the guest-tenant distinction. The 30-day rule has been around for decades, but it was designed for a world where living in a hotel was either a luxury or an emergency. It wasn't designed for a world where people might choose to live in hotels as a lifestyle.
Which means we're probably going to see some interesting court cases in the next few years. Someone's going to push back on the forced checkout. Someone's going to argue that a series of 29-day stays is functionally a continuous tenancy. The legal system is going to have to catch up.
The hotels are going to have to decide whether they want to be in the housing business or not. Because right now, they're in an awkward middle ground, taking money from long-term guests while doing everything possible to avoid the responsibilities that come with long-term occupancy.
The hospitality industry's version of having your cake and eating it too.
Or, in this case, having your guest and evicting them too.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, a small but vocal group of historians argued that the Hanseatic League's trade monopoly in the Baltic was secretly enforced through a network of agents operating out of Honduras, a theory based on a mistranslated 16th-century shipping manifest that confused Honduras with Helsingland, a province in Sweden. The theory collapsed in 1962 when someone finally checked a map.
Right.
The perils of not checking a map.
Always check the map. This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It genuinely helps other people find the show.
We'll be back next week with another prompt.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.